Hello, and welcome to The Musical Activist. I'm Sarah Nichols. I'm a pianist and composer, and I wanted to find out how, as a musician, I can respond to the headline that we've got 12 years to save the planet.
12 years!
Today, I'm with Dr. Alex Dietzel on Zoom. Hello.
Hi.
And this is the first time we're meeting, which is really exciting. Thank you so much for coming to speak to the post-show discussion after my concert, which is now tomorrow, which is very exciting. So hopefully I'll get this podcast published pretty quickly. This is the start of the 12 years tour, which I started writing inspired by the IPCC report in autumn 2018 that said we had 12 years to halve global emissions, to keep global warming under 1.5 degrees. Now, the reason I want to get people like you involved in this is because you know so much more about all of this than I do. I'm basically a punter reading headlines and then freaking out on my piano. So perhaps you can tell us about your research area and your professional kind of perspective.
Yeah, so I'm a lecturer at the University of Bristol, and my specialism is climate justice, which I've been doing for almost a decade, but has recently become a kind of topic that is discussed in headlines and by school children, and, you know, which is great. And means I get to do a lot more, you know, public engagement, which I love as an academic. I think it's so important. But my specialism is kind of to look at the global response to climate change by states and non-state actors like cities or individuals, and make a kind of moral judgment, like, are we responding in a just, in a fair manner? Are we protecting human rights? And so on. And if not, you know, what could we be doing better? So I take a kind of critical lens to the global response to climate change and try to evaluate it, which is tricky because it's incredibly complex. So I recently wrote a book about this, and I compared the state and non-state response and kind of tried to make a judgment about which side was doing better, if any. And unfortunately, they're both really failing, as is probably not a surprise. But I found the non-state response marginally more exciting. So now my new work is kind of focusing on that side.
And when you say non-state, can you just explain what you mean?
Yeah, so I mean any actor that's not a state. So like a city could be a non-state actor, an individual could be, an NGO could be, even a corporation could be a non-state actor fighting climate change. So anyone who's not kind of part of this state-based response to climate change, which has brought us the Paris Agreement, and which, you know, where the states gather every year to talk about what to do about climate change, anyone who's kind of separate from that is a non-state actor. So it's a really broad category.
So what does that make you think in terms of the sort of conversation that goes on about individual behavior change and, you know, system change? What's your view on that?
So I think system change is really important, and we live in a system that is malleable. And I do think systemic change is possible. And I think for me, non-state actors, especially cities and individuals as well in groups, are really pushing for systemic change much more than states are. So in terms of systemic change and like rapid, you know, shifts in behavior, I don't think that states are kind of moving towards that at the global level together. I think they're making incremental, business as usual kind of, small changes and making these kind of big global agreements around very vague promises. Whereas cities, for example, like even Bristol as a city, is acting more radically and setting emissions targets that are much lower than the UK targets, for example. Mm. So that really interests me and gives me a bit of hope.
And can you talk a little bit about the justice aspect? It's really interesting that you say moral judgment, because so much. I mean, when I was an academic, I found it was so much about like proving how, you know, objective you are. But it's very interesting that you use the word judgment. So just, yeah, can you?
Well, I'm technically a moral philosopher, you know, so a political philosopher, but like I deal with moral questions, what is right and wrong. So I am, it's literally my job to make these moral judgments, which is great. So I'm allowed to do that in my work, in my field, that is what it's all about, finding the truth and or if not the moral truth, at least like some notion of right and wrong. So making judgments, for me is about very simple, small measurements, like are human rights being protected and which human rights in particular? Are we including the voices of the most vulnerable in the conversation about climate change? Are we pursuing adaptation to climate change as much as lowering emissions? Are we getting ready for climate change because it's happening and will get worse? And are we, you know, are responsible actors, high emitting, rich actors, including corporations, individuals, cities, are they being held to account and how? So those are the kinds of things that I investigate.
So, I mean, it would actually be quite fun to dip into some of those questions. The voices of the vulnerable, I mean, as you say, it's been a kind of extraordinary year of all of us waking up more to what the area that you're studying. So when you think about the voices of the vulnerable and how they're heard, can you just talk about that for a moment?
Well, if we think about it at the kind of global state level, so let's say when the Paris Agreement gets negotiated, it's a well-studied area where people have shown that voices from the global south, so from the kind of countries that are less developed, I guess is another way to put it, I prefer the term global south, are often left out of negotiations. And it's in two ways. One, because they might not have a big negotiating team that speaks English with them and that can go to multiple meetings, because at these conferences, there's multiple meetings happening. And two, a lot of the decisions get made in what's called corridor diplomacy. So chatting between diplomats or representatives in kind of informal settings, and voices from the global south are not always included in those informal settings. So what you see when you look at, for example, the negotiation document, so this big document that's been developed over a couple of years comes to negotiation and gets shortened and things get taken out. If you follow the pattern of like what the negotiation document looked like at the beginning and then what the Paris Agreement looks like at the end, you can really see the powerful states getting their way and kind of watering things down and taking down certain clauses that the Global South wanted to put in, and they simply get outvoted or spoken over. And so at that state level, it's pretty well researched that the voices from the Global South are not being included, or from indigenous populations are not being included to the same extent as those voices from the more powerful nations from the Global North.
Do you work with Farhana Yamin at all? I'm just thinking about
No.
Okay. For anyone that is listening, Culture Declares, she's a very interesting person who was representing the, I can't remember what the phrase is, but basically places like the Maldives in the Paris Agreement talks. Yeah.
Well, one small of the island COP, states. Anyway.
Right, thank you. Yeah. So that's really alarming, isn't it? I mean, it's basically like those sort of terrible fancy receptions that any of us have ever been invited to, where you turn up and you're really nervous because there's like, you know, three really famous people and then some other quite famous people. And then there's some like really sort of beautiful and glamorous people. And then there's you feeling like, I don't know who to talk to. I don't know anyone. And you sort of stand on the edge feeling like a, you know, bit of a Wally and go home early. But isn't that alarming that that's kind of the pattern of like a global agreement? So what you're saying about the non-state, the individuals, the cities, the NGOs, actually that they would have more impressive sort of stats, if you like, because
it's unfortunately the patterns that exist at the global scale are repeated in non-state action as well. So they're not perfect angels who are completely the opposite. So there are certain patterns of exclusion, you know. So for example, a lot of non-state initiatives that are quite famous are in the global north, you know, like C40 cities was established by cities.
Right,
C40 is a group of like large cities in the world combating climate change and kind of exchanging knowledge. So that's a really famous example, and it was founded by cities in the global north. So even if they, you know, include cities that are in the global south, like the fact that it was founded by these cities in the global north shows you a kind of pattern of how these really famous non-state actors emerge at the global level. And then even academics who study this kind of non-state action, they often focus on initiatives that have English-speaking websites and, you know, for ease of study. So they're kind of privileged because they get attention and people study them and maybe fund them more. So there are some patterns like that. But what I'm looking at in my research now is whether there's scope within non-state actors or actions for more inclusion of voices. So for example, if you look at Extinction Rebellion, you know, they've been accused of being very middle class and white and excluding voices. So I'm interested to see whether they take that criticism on board and kind of try to include voices, the most vulnerable, more. And I actually just got a very small grant to study this in the city of Bristol with a friend of mine, Alice Venn, who is a lecturer at the law school in Exeter. And we're going to have a look at some initiatives in the city of Bristol to see how decisions are made and whether voices are included.
I mean, it's
so I don't want to give the impression that non-state actors are like the answer to everything and they're perfect.
No, but it's very interesting.
I think there's more scope for it.
It's very interesting, though, isn't it? Because we are all, you know, trying to do our bit and trying to work out what our bit is. And
yes.
How can we help, do you think, listeners to this? What can we do to help address this kind of pattern of power? And
I mean, it's difficult because it's so ingrained in our systems. You know, it's like racism or gender inequality. It's very, very similar. You know, the structures are there to like kind of block us from really making significant change. But I guess as an individual, you could just be mindful, you know, if you are at a climate protest or something like that, are there groups that look like they're not being included? Or is there someone new you could talk to? Or is there somebody in your circle of friends or, you know, even acquaintances that you could take along to climate marches and see if their voices might be included? You know, things like that. But I think it's hard to place that on individuals. It's really, you know, it's right. Like, how do you defeat the patriarchy as an individual? Like, it's a similar kind of question,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, being mindful of it is important. And using your power and privilege and acknowledging that you know, there's a reason you have time to take time off work to go to these climate protests and, you know, things like that. Or you can buy certain things like electric vehicles. So that is a position of privilege.
One thing that would be brilliant is if we just attach a few little links to this when we publish it, so that if people want to go and do a bit of further reading, that'd be great just to kind of point people, start them off on a journey of learning a bit more about this. What did I want to ask you? I was interested when you were talking about English speaking. How do you get around the challenge of linguistics?
You hire researchers from the Global South to help you do your fieldwork.
Right.
You know, that would be one thing, you know, to collaborate with other researchers and make sure that they understand the local context. And that's hard, you know, because in academia, often you don't have the time or the money. So you just work with colleagues, you know, and they're usually from the Global North. And then you get together and you do a study and you think, okay, who can we study? Here, these are English speaking. Let's focus on them. So it's something I'm thinking about in my own work. So I just got this small grant to do the city-led research in Bristol. And Alice and I are hoping that if we do get this project off the ground, that we can then do a project at the global scale and collaborate with people from the Global South. And actually, you know, this pandemic has opened up a lot of new kind of ways to think about research and how to do things. You know, maybe we don't have to fly to a small island state to speak with people there. Maybe we can actually hook up with a researcher at a university and catch up with them on Zoom, and they do the field work and you know, they understand the local context and we leave it up to them and then they report back to us. So it's things like that that you could do to get around that problem. Yeah.
Can you give us some headline ways in which people are vulnerable to climate change? I mean, I know what I think, but you're researching it. So can you just give us sort of headline?
I mean, I focus, for example, on health. So the human right to health and how climate change affects your health. And it can be things like, you know, heat stress, not having a cool place to sleep or to kind of cool down and you know, lack of water, which means you get dehydrated and you can fall seriously ill from that. climate change can displace people, and you can end up in a refugee camp with very little access to clean water and, you know, good food and things like that. It can affect health in weird ways. Like it can make mosquitoes more prevalent because they like warmer weather, and then you're more susceptible to things like malaria. And you know, it can disrupt housing, so it could cause flooding and damage housing and displace people in that way. You know, there's lots of different ways it can affect your health, and that's why I focus on health, because I find it quite a big area to look at.
One of the kind of biggest looming crises, which is clearly already underway, is about displacement. And, you know, just the fairness of distribution of land that's actually safely inhabited, as you say, you know, and there's a lot of terrifying predictions about the heat of countries. Can you just say something about that? Like, how do you see that trajectory, and what do you think?
So the kind of predictions really highlight the injustice of climate change, because the countries that will be most affected are mostly in the global south and have little adaptive capacity. So it's kind of like unlucky geography, plus unlucky because global north countries are emitting so much that they're causing climate change. So the trajectory, is really scary. It's really terrifying. And it makes me quite upset to think about the millions, if not billions, of lives that will be affected. And it's a lot to shoulder as a researcher. So you have to kind of look into the areas where things are going well, to give you a little bit of hope to keep going with your research. But yeah, I read the IPCC reports when they come out, and I read the same news headlines as you as well, you know, and it does scare me. But I'm also lucky to be linked up to lots of really smart IPCC scientists working at the University of Bristol. And I see the work that they're putting in, and I see, you know, the climate activism in Bristol and things like that. So I do think there are a lot of people working in the right direction to push, you know, push for systemic change.
I mean, it seemed to me that Extinction Rebellion did make moves in the right direction for their latest events. They did have global justice marches, and, you know, rather than just it being in the chant, it did seem to be something that was sort of becoming more tangible and more real. Like, it did seem that there was a greater diversity of voices. Did you think that?
I haven't been to an Extinction Rebellion event in a little while, so I can't comment on that.
I wasn't there, but I watched it on Facebook Live.
Right. I think they're trying, for sure. You know, they're getting a lot of flack for being, like I said, like a middle-class white organization. So I do think they're trying to very hard. And they have this, I think someone explained to me when I went to one of the protests, they have this system where nobody's really in charge, and, you know, they try to make sure that decisions are made democratically and things like that. So that's certainly interesting. I'm also really interested in the school movements and Greta Thunberg and, you know, children getting involved, because they are very vulnerable to climate change, and their voices are ignored because they can't vote, you know, and they're often brushed aside. So that really interests me. And I love that that has such a global movement, and you can see, you know, pictures from around the world of children protesting. It's really powerful.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, they're sort of the most vulnerable group, really, aren't they? Because they're going to be here for the longest. So I'm aware we've got limited time, and I'm trying to remember everything I'd like to ask you. It's brilliant to have you. I'm so pleased, and it's going to be a really nice balance, I think, with Rich Pankost, because you've got such kind of different perspectives coming into the conversation.
Well, he's a scientist and I'm a social scientist, so that is really interesting. Definitely.
I suppose I want to ask you something enormous, like, you know, in terms of the sort of moral judgments, in terms of the values that sort of lead those questions, in terms of human rights, how do we make sure that, you know, the values do, you know, the right values are in the people that lead us? You know, how do we promote that? Because, you know, you can look at these things and say, are the right things going on? But if they're not, how do we, you know?
Well, it's really difficult, because people who come into power are often not, you know, there for for the best reasons. Like, they just love being in power, and that feels good, you know. Or the people with the most money in the world are not often the most kind of philanthropic and willing to share. And, you know, I saw some statistic the other day about how much money it would take to, like, ready us for climate change or to lower emissions versus the amount of money the head of Amazon has, you know. And, like, it was just a small percentage of his wealth. So it's astounding, like, you know, we have the people in power who could be doing incredible things for climate change, and they just don't. So, I mean, I wish I had the magic answer of how to get them to change their minds. I think people who are in power like being in power. So showing them what we want and what will keep them in power can steer them a bit, you know. So if it's obvious that people want green growth, or they want, degrowth, or they want systemic change in that direction, then they can vote for that, and they can go to protests, and they can keep shouting about it. But in the end, like, you know, systems are in place, and they're really powerful. This is not the only area where people are pushing for systemic change and struggling. Like I mentioned, you know, race and gender and things like that. It's really similar patterns, you know, where there's a lot of people who are really concerned and trying to put effort in the right direction. And then there's the other side, you know, where people are kind of misled or not using their kind of moral judgment to vote. And yeah, so I don't know if there's like a straightforward answer other than.
No, well, I don't think there is, but yeah, exactly. Well, it's just good to hear from you because you are thinking about it all the time. I'm really looking forward to having you in the post-show discussion. It's going to be brilliant. Thank you so much for being involved. And we will add some references to this episode so that people can do a little bit of reading about Alex's research. And
also, if you're not interested in academic research, there's a great podcast called Mothers of Invention, which is all about climate change justice. And it's led by Mary Robinson, who's amazing, and a comedian whose name escapes me, but it's brilliant. So if you don't want to read a boring academic book or article.
Excellent. We'll put the link to that as
podcast.
Well. Fantastic. Thank you very much. Thanks for speaking to us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
12 years.
Book now at sounduk.net to watch 12 years live online and come to post-show discussions with experts like Alex Dietzel. Thank you.